Okay.
Poor training.
Everybody wanna mute so I don't have an echo? Dr. Elon or Dr. Foreman, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Perfect.
Can you hear me? Thank you.
All right, let's start from the top. Practical tips for regulating board members for getting complaints, Arizona State Board of Podiatry Examiners. And we're not reinventing the wheel here. There's really good information in here because it's standing on the shoulders of those who came before me. So, resolving complaints, board options. Obviously, the board resolves complaints at public meetings, just like you do today. It is important to know the stage of the proceeding because a licensee has certain entitlements at different stages, and the board's options vary according to the stage. And that really is just talking about due process rights. Timing, you have 35 days to respond if the board is going to take action. If it's an initial review, obviously, it's not going to be the same. The board's only going to be offering disciplinary consents or issuing non-disciplinary orders or letters of concern. So resolving complaints, still understand what conduct constitutes a violation and what actions the board can take at each stage of the proceedings. For example, you can dismiss, issue a non-disciplinary letter of concern, continue the investigation if you feel that you need more information, move to an informal hearing if you simply need to hear from either the respondent or the complainant and plan on taking some kind of disciplinary action. Investigators review cases according to the board's parameters and make recommendations. The board, as the decision maker, can accept, reject, or modify those recommendations, which, as we see oftentimes, in a vacuum review of medical documentation, often the investigator will substantiate violations or allegations that once the board has the opportunity to discuss more thoroughly with the respondent, the board ends up unsubstantiating, which is a normal process, and that happens with most boards. Your authority for investigative reviews is under ARS Section 32852.01, subsections A through C. And that's where you review the investigative report and provide materials. After the investigative review, like you had today, you can dismiss, file a letter of concern, issue a non-disciplinary order for continuing education. And as we discussed today, if a letter of concern and a non-disciplinary order for continuing education function the same way. They're on the same non-disciplinary plane, and the use of it is when somebody gets another complaint, if it's related to that letter of concern or that non-disciplinary order for continuing education, you can ratchet up that the disposition to possibly disciplinary or, stronger terms for probation. And again, they offer a consent agreement with terms. And then summary suspension. My time on this board, there's never been a summary suspension. Thank God. Must find protection of public requires emergency action. So basically, the statute says that in order to protect the public, the board must imperatively take an emergency action. So that's kind of those are the buzzwords there. And hopefully we don't have to deal with any summary suspensions. Next is your informal hearing. That's under ARS Section 32852.01D. And in the informal hearing, as we discussed, so informal hearing, you're going to move a matter to an informal hearing if you believe that you need to take disciplinary action. Often that's going to result from an investigative review in which you offer a disciplinary consent agreement, and if not signed by the respondent, then you move to the informal hearing. The other reason to use an informal hearing is because you need to interview either the respondent or the complainant. You're not going to want to move forward to an informal hearing if you don't believe that you have enough documentary evidence to substantiate any violations. And then after that is your formal hearing. And again, in my time here, we have not had a formal hearing. And that is under ARS section 32852.01E. And at that point, you have all disciplinary options, including revocation, suspension, probation with terms, including a civil penalty, which according to the board statutes is $2,000 maximum per violation. The board's formal hearings, if there were to be one, would be scheduled before the board. The respondent always has the option to remove the formal hearing from the board and have it held at the administrative office of hearings. And at that point, I can just go into that. If the matter went to the office of administrative hearings, I would handle the case. We would argue it in front of an administrative law judge. At that time, the administrative law judge would make a determination on what they thought was appropriate discipline, and the matter would come back to the board. In the past, the way it used to work was that the board then had the option to accept, reject, or modify the ALJ's decision. However, law passed 2 years ago, now gives, it was 2 years ago, yeah, I think it was 2 years ago. It gives the respondent the option to accept the ALJ's decision. And you could imagine when that would happen. If the board wanted revocation or, you know, a long-term probation with terms, and the ALJ offers some kind of non-disciplinary or, you know, a very light disciplinary consent agreement or order, the respondent can accept that offer, and the board does not have the ability to accept, reject, or modify that consent agreement, I mean that order by the ALJ anymore. There is a provision for meeting and conferring after the ALJ decision, at which time the board may have other options. Now, we're not gonna worry about that hypothetically. We'll wait to see if we ever get that kind of case before this board. But that is kind of the procedural posture now. Licensees are entitled to have the board make decisions based solely on the facts presented in the case at hand. This is very important. You know, don't speak to investigate any board investigators outside of board meetings about cases. Don't do any independent research. You know, don't even go on the board's website and, you know, query the professional licensor search to see if there's any, you know, past discipline against a respondent. We really want to make sure that everything that you do and all your decisions are based solely on what you have in the record in front of you. The facts are derived from information and documents provided by the complainant, the licensee, staff investigator, and possibly a professional consultant or expert. And sometimes you will also have information from the subsequent treating physician, which can help you make your decision. Or sometimes it can muddy the water, so just important to keep that in mind. Individual board members should not go out and do their own investigation or research. This could lead to, you know, you needing to recuse from hearing a matter, and because the board is very short right now, and it's right on the line, it's right on the quorum line, you know, we wouldn't be able to hear a matter if you had to recuse. Doing so may disqualify the board member from participating and jeopardize the board's decision. So in the event that you do outside research and you take action against somebody and don't recuse yourself, and then somebody finds out about it, you can be open to, not only will the board's decision be in jeopardy, but also you will be opening yourself to personal civil liability. At that point, I would not be representing you. You would have to get outside counsel for yourself. At the board meeting, professional members may apply their own experience and training. Again, the reason you are appointed is the expertise that you should bring to every matter. Whether you're a professional member or a public member, your insight is important to the discussion. Practice trends may change, so it's important to keep up to date with current standards of care as they relate to your profession. And that's an important one, because even in Even in my profession, laws change every year. And if you're not up to date, then you may be advising or laboring under false assumptions. Okay, resolving complaints prior in prior history. Do not refer to or ask questions about previous board actions against the licensee unless and until the board determines that a violation has occurred in the case at hand. The fact that a licensee has a history of discipline is relevant only to the penalty and not to whether the allegations in the present case are true or not. And the easiest example of that is when you're in criminal court. When you're in criminal court during the trial, you are not allowed to bring up most things about the individual's personality, or you can't prove that they committed a burglary because they had committed a burglary 10 years prior. So what happens then is, after the jury determines that you have committed an infraction, violation, a crime, then they will make findings and they will make a determination on what should happen to you. After that, then you go to court the last time for your sentencing and penalty phase. At the sentencing and penalty phase, that is the only time that the court will usually take into consideration actions that happened in the past, especially if those criminal violations or violations relate to the crime at hand. So it's the same for us. The board reviews a matter, determines that disciplinary conduct occurred, you make findings of fact and conclusions of law, and the last thing you do is your sentencing. And after you've already found a violation and you're ready to proceed your sentencing, then you can ask Heather, does this individual have any priors? And then you consider the prior. Does the prior relate to the current complaint before the board? Stay focused on the case. Board members may wish to ask themselves, what are the allegations? What information or documentation is needed to decide whether the allegations are true? And do I have that information or do I need more? And what information is credible and persuasive? If the allegations are true, what penalty is appropriate? And I think, as you saw today, you guys do a very good job about this. You do a good job of weighing what the investigator substantiates with what the complaints about, with also what the attorney and respondent have to say about their care of the patient. And again, information, really, that's just your evidence. If you're going to take disciplinary action for failure to have adequate consent, then you want to have evidence that directly relates to inadequate consent, such as, a consent that's not signed, a consent that's actually not there, a consent that discusses other procedures. So that's just one area of evidence where you need to substantiate a violation in that area. While each case is different, facts vary. Licensees have a varied disciplinary history. Strive to issue consistent discipline, which I think that's self-explanatory. Just be consistent with everybody who comes before the board and make sure that you're not taking action that's inconsistent because of, personal feelings. Consistency in decision-making is critical. Need to avoid challenges of decision-making as arbitrary, capricious, or an abuse of discretion. And usually the test is, did what you do, was it an enumerated violation in the board statute? And if it was an enumerated violation in the board statute, did the punishment the board chose, was it also enumerated in their statute? So if you committed a violation of the Podiatry Practice Act, and under 854.01, the board has the authority to issue the disposition or discipline that you do, then the court is not going to consider that arbitrary, capricious, or abuse of discretion, because it's within your powers. But what you want to make sure that you also do is make sure that that's consistent with other decisions you have made in the past. Every case It is heard on its own merits. Every decision is made on its own. You're not setting precedent. But again, it is important to make sure that you don't take action for the same issues against an individual, against two different similarly situated individuals, which I don't think that's been an issue either. All right, motion practice. Oh, no.
Yeah, I don't think you want to do that.
Okay. Sorry about that. I lost it. Okay. So there are six general steps in completing a motion. That's making the motion, seconding the motion, repeating the motion, discussing the motion, voting on the motion, and then announcing the result of the vote. And that really, again, just creates a really clear record. And the attorney, any individual, any respondent can go, you know, on, they can review the audio or look at the minutes and see the see exactly what the board did and why the board did what they did. It's important to make good motions. You don't want to rely on staff to have to clean up your motion, because that can leave your motion open to challenge by the respondent. You also want to say, you know, when you're making a motion, you know, some of the best language is, you know, I move or I motion, right? You're not going to want to say, well, I'm thinking of a motion, or, you know, I'd like to make a motion. You want to make sure you're more definitive. This is the motion I'm making. And discussion may precede a motion. Chair asks, do I have a motion? Is there a motion? Only one motion at a time. So you don't want to have dueling motions. You'll second it. If the motion seems like nobody really agrees with it, you don't want to vote on it, then you can just request that the motion maker rescind their motion. And you can go back into discussion or making another motion. The best practice is the chair does not make motions or second them. However, for a small board of three members, for example, it may be necessary for the chair to do so, which is common, you know, when boards are, they have, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11 members on the board, the chair will usually spend more time having other people make motions, but really it's just a matter of preference. That's a Robert's Rule issue. It's not a statutory requirement. Again, after being recognized by the chair, make a motion by saying, I move that, or I make a motion that. Example, I move that the board grant Lily Amir's application for licensure. Don't say I motion that. Do not simply say so moved, or things like, I move the committee recommendation. The following types of statements are not motions. I'm thinking about, I suggest that, I recommend that, I want to, and the way we help out the motion maker with that is we don't second the motion. We just say, can you please clarify your motion again? So, you know, we just want to be very, very deliberative and purposeful when we're doing things. A specific board member or staff should be designated to write down each motion as it is made, which is Heather. ask the maker to repeat or clarify the motion if it is incomplete, unclear, or nonsensical. Making an adequate motion is the board's responsibility. Don't expect staff to clean up a nonsensical or incomplete motion after the meeting. And I'll always, you know, Heather and I will always do our best to make sure that, you know, that your motions are good. That way we don't have to worry about those issues. An adequate motion uses clear and understandable language. For example, I move that we issue a letter of concern and concerns that the licensee failed to respond to the board subpoena before the deadline. And again, you guys are good. You're good with letters of concern, but it's just a short statement of the board's concern, not a full recitation of the allegations and the issues. Without waiting to be recognized, another member seconds the motion by saying second, or I second the motion. Without a second, the motion dies. The chair or other designated person should repeat the motion. For example, it has been moved by Ms. Gray and seconded by Mr. Brown that we grant Jackson Abel's license application. And again, that just is clear for the record. And then Heather doesn't have to receive calls from lawyers and respondents saying that they don't know what happened. More formal style procedure requires a motion and second before discussion. Informally, many boards permit discussion before a motion is made in order to help members formulate a motion, which is fine. You guys do that too. Today Dr. Campbell said, does anybody have any, I have thoughts, but does anybody else have any thoughts? This is what I'm thinking about the matter. I don't see an issue of standard of care, right? And that just kind of helps frame the discussion and help push the board to, a motion that they're more comfortable with. Informally, after the second, the chair calls for discussion if the matter has not already been discussed. Is there any discussion? And you'll find that some boards, they never have discussion. They go immediately from the motion and the second to the vote. But it's good to have discussion. It really is. All right, stay focused on the allegations at hand. Avoid drifting to other topics. For example, if the allegation is that the licensee violated a particular board rule, then discuss the evidence that supports or contradicts the violation. Discussion of whether the rule is a good rule or not is irrelevant. If the board wants to review its rules, put that on a future agenda. And that's happened at quite a few meetings I've been at. It's very awkward. And it really undermines the board's ability to do its work in front of the public. If the board does not believe that it has good statutes and rules, again, it's the board's duty then to attempt to straighten those rules out and clarify them, as opposed to complaining to the public that they have bad statutes and rules. It is helpful if each board member begins his or her comments by stating, I speak against the motion, or I speak in favor of the motion. I think that's kind of a flavor thing. I'm not really I don't think you need to do that. It's another Roberts rule. I think people can understand if you're speaking in favor of the motion. Let all members who wish to speak have a turn first before any member speaks for a second time, which, again, I think you guys do a great job with that aspect. Don't interrupt each other. I haven't heard you do that. Interruptions made for an unclear record can cause confusion. Feel free to express respectful disagreement. Again, as I stated, you're here on the board because of the expertise. You're appointed to the board because of the expertise that you have. And so bringing your expertise to every case is really what you're here for. And that's going to help the other board members to flesh out what they believe are true violations or not. If one or more board members habitually dominates the discussion, the chair may wish to vary the order in which members are called on. Again, that's not required. That's just part of Robert's rules. Board members should read the board materials in advance so they're prepared to discuss the matters on the agenda. It's right there. It's very obvious when the board members are unprepared. I don't know if board members realize that, but it's very obvious if you haven't read the materials and can't contribute to the discussion. Every member need not necessarily comment on every case, but there should be some discussion before a vote is taken. If imposing a penalty, one or more members should explain why that penalty is more appropriate than some other penalty. And this brings me to a good point, too. Often, because of the nature of the complaints you get and being physicians, the respondent or the respondent's attorney will provide the board with scholarly articles or documentation to support their position. And if the board doesn't agree, or does agree, either way, the board should always take the chance to review those materials and speak to, on the record, why they believe that, that documentation or support for what they did is sufficient or isn't sufficient, but it's very a good idea when anything is ever appealed. One of the questions that the Spirit Board will ask is, well, the respondent provided you this. What do the boards say about this information? So it's always good just to address everything that you're given, especially expert opinion that's provided. Okay. And again, when we talked about consistency, so if the board decides that they're going to impose a penalty on an individual that is similarly situated than other individuals, then the board's going to want to say, okay, well, while the case is similar, these are the differences, and this is why the board is not taking its normal action in this case, but, you know, maybe moving beyond that. Okay, after discussion, chair calls for the vote. Vote may be made by group voice vote, a roll call of each member. Telephonic means a roll call vote is conducted, usually, but the rule is with matters of discipline is usually when you're going to have a roll call vote, while in other circumstances you're just going to have a voice vote. No anonymous votes or secret ballots, no voting by proxy, which I did have a board a couple of years ago. I had a board member show up and say, oh, I'm voting for this board member. They told me how they wanted me to vote. Please don't ever do that. You can't unring that bell on the record. So, you know, again, repeat the motion again immediately before voting. Chair asks all those in favor, and then all those opposed, and then anyone abstaining. Chair announces the results of the vote. Motion passes unanimously. Motion passes 4-3. Motion fails. A tie vote means that the motion fails. After a tie vote, further discussion is often helpful. The chair may ask for a new motion. All right, abstention and recusal. To abstain means the board member declines to vote. In the absence of a reason for mandatory recusal or a genuine appearance of impropriety, board members have a duty to decide matters that come before them. For example, members should not abstain merely because the matter is controversial, difficult to decide, or involves a particular person or issue. Examples: board member was not present for all the discussion or consideration of the case. Board member was unable to review the materials for that case. And so that first bullet point is really the important one. If you miss a large chunk of the discussion or you miss the executive session, you know, you really should ask yourself, can I make a determination on this case? Do I understand the materials well enough? And did I hear enough of the discussion that I can actually make a reasoned decision? And if not, then you're going to want to abstain. To recuse means to remove oneself from participation to avoid a conflict of interest or other impermissible circumstance. The recused member is disqualified on that matter. No discussion, no vote, nothing. Recused members should leave the table. Recusal is mandatory for statutory conflicts of interest and for bias, prejudice, and prejudgment. And, you know, if Heather knows ahead of time if you have a conflict, you know, then the board materials can always be augmented to account for that conflict. At the same time, you know, if you do realize that you have a conflict and you need to recuse, and it's after you've received the materials, then I would just respectfully request that, you know, you do the right thing and not review the materials for that matter that you're recused from. You should leave the table. You can, you know, different boards are different ways. Some board members will push back from the table and, you know, sit against the wall in your chair, that's fine. Others will get up and go sit in the gallery. I know the Roberts rules would probably say that's more appropriate to go sit in the gallery. Recusal is mandatory for statutory conflicts of interest and we already went over that, but, you know, your statutory conflicts are going to be any kind of enumeration, any kind of monetary gain, whether that be for you or loss, whether that be for you or a family member. So if you do, you know, it's hard to get into every situation in which there may be a recusal. But if you feel like, you know, and I think all three of you at some point or another have asked me about a specific matter and whether you should recuse. So please just continue to do that and we can discuss you know, the situation whenever it arises. But you always can feel free to reach out to me if you want to discuss an abstention or recusal. And be prepared, be fair, and you cannot help but do good works. And that's it. So unless anybody has any specific questions, usually with the training, you know, it's just if you have anything, you can reach out to me by email or call me, and then as these issues come up, we'll address them.
So, and both abstention and recusal affects quorum.
Well, differently. Yes. Recusal will, the board will lose the ability to hear it. Abstention, necessarily the board won't lose the ability to hear it because recusal is about your ability to hear anything about the case, where abstention is more about the voting comes in the end. So, and if you don't know if you should abstain or recuse, again, that's a good reason why, you know, just reach out to me and we can discuss it. All right, thank you.
So,
thank you, James.
Anyway, so let's move on to Heather's Executive Director's Report.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Board Members. To date, 400 renewals have been approved. There are a few renewals that are pending that I still need information for. The board's rule package was submitted to the Secretary of State's office on June 19th for the final notice of rulemaking, and I was notified that the rules will become effective on August 18th. Additionally, after I sent out board materials, I did submit the board's five-year rule review report to the Governor's Regulatory Review Council, and that was submitted on July 6th. The deadline was July 31st. I've not been notified of when the report will be reviewed by the Governor's Regulatory Review Council, but I will keep the board updated on that. I did provide the most current budget that's been provided, and no new complaints have been added to the complaint log since I sent materials. I can answer any questions.
Thank you, Heather. Okay, so any summary for current events? And number nine is our call to the public. And there is no public to call. We have no public on the line. Does anyone under the next heading 10 have any items they'd like to see on future meeting agendas? And then our next board meeting is August the 9th, 2023 at 8 a.m. And does anyone have anything else to add since it appears that all our agenda items have been addressed? So I will make a motion to adjourn the meeting at 9:50 a.m.
I second the motion.
Thank you, Dr. Foreman. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Thank you.
Putting the training to work already.
I did. Yes. No, let's go for it.
You did it.
All right. Have a great day, guys.
Have a great day. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye now.
Bye.